Welcome to the Between the Lines podcast, a weekly literary author interview program produced by WABE Atlanta.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Visa, offering the Visa Signature Card, featuring concierge services for travel, dining, and entertainment at visasignature.com.
Hello, I'm Valerie Jackson, and today I'm going between the lines of Madame Chiang Kai-shek, China's Eternal First Lady, by Laura Tyson Lee. Laura spent over 10 years living in China, Hong Kong, and Taiwan, reporting for the South China Morning Post and as Taiwan correspondent for the Financial Times. She also happens to be fluent in Mandarin Chinese. Thank you so much for joining us today, Laura.
It's great to be here.
Well, my, what a book, Madame Chiang Kai-shek. What an ambitious, elegant, intelligent woman who, in many ways, altered the course of Chinese history. This biography of yours reveals so much more that I never knew. And I don't know whether it was because of personal or political reasons that we didn't know about it, but some say she was a godsend, while others thought she was an evil dragon lady. Whichever, Madame Chiang Kai-shek was no ordinary woman. But I guess that's not surprising, though, since she comes from kind of an unusual family. Tell us about the family history for Mei Ling.
Madame Chiang Kai-shek comes from a really, truly unique Chinese family. Her, first of all, she came from a Christian family, which at that time in China was very unusual. Her parents were devout Methodists. And her father had actually been educated in the States in the 1870s and 1880s as a Methodist missionary with the intention of going back to China to preach to the Chinese and attempt to convert them, as were so many other American missionaries in China at the time. And she grew up in Shanghai, which was a colonial enclave in China, and therefore not what we would think of as the life of the vast majority of Chinese living in pretty much mostly poverty in rural China.
Mm. What was the name of the family? Was it Song?
The Song family.
Song family. There were complaints, though, that she wasn't Chinese enough sometimes, that she displayed little ethnic pride. And as a matter of fact, tell us about her going to school here in Georgia.
Well, her father, since he had gone to school, Charlie Song, he'd gone to school in the States. He felt that all his children should also go to school today in the States. There were three daughters, the three Song sisters, and three sons, and all of them at one point or another went to school in the States. And she started out going to school here in Georgia in Macon at Wesleyan College, which is still a women's college. The three sisters all went there. I guess he thought it would be a safe place, given that it was a Methodist school. Mm. And then later she went up north to Wellesley College outside Boston in Massachusetts. So she spent 10 years of her youth in the United States without ever returning to China. Really formative years for her.
Actually, she really called herself a Southern lady, didn't she? That was an incident where she didn't want to hear about.
That's right. When she was up north studying, I think maybe summer school or something, the teacher asked her to talk about Sherman's Sherman's
march to the sea
through Georgia. And she said, that subject's very painful to me. I don't want to talk about it. And she did have a Southern twinge to her voice. She spoke beautiful, perfect English. In fact, amazing. She was amazingly
better English than Chinese, probably.
Better English than Chinese, mm-hmm. And better English than the vast majority of Americans, I'd have to say. But it had a Southern twinge combined with almost a British-y twinge, too. So it was a very interesting accent.
You mentioned she went up to Wellesley in the north, and one of the graduates of that college later on said that Wellesley students were not groomed to be heroines of their own lives, but rather, quote, first ladies in the lives of big men. So did Mei Ling, and that was Madame Chiang's name, Mei Ling, did she adopt this creed, this philosophy?
Well, I think, and I argue in the book, I think that she did to some extent. She absorbed that. I mean, there was sort of a a deep ambivalence at Wellesley at that time. Women were supposed to be, the students were groomed to be intellectual and thinkers and, you know, pioneers in their own independent women and so on and so forth. But at the same time, there was also this very strong training, you know, this dual sort of training that you were to be a good hostess and, you know, a good entertainer and, you know, an educated wife to compliment a husband, you know, and to look for a husband, too.
But at Wellesley, though, I think that's where she first, well, where maybe it's first mentioned about her little fits, her little what appeared to be maybe manic depression.
Right. And I talk about this in the book, too, that over the years she appeared to go into these spells of depression. And then the rest of the time she was just a dynamo, like incredible energy. And many of the people I interviewed just spoke of her her incandescent kind of energy and magnetism that she had. She was really a charismatic person. And universally, everywhere everyone I spoke to who knew her or people who had written about her said that she was much more attractive in person than she was in photographs, and she's already very photogenic. Mm-hmm. So she truly was one of those people that had this kind of energy and magnetism about
something about her spirit.
Right. Yeah. And so I, at the end, by the end of the book, I had to say what was going on, because she spent long spells in hospitals with mysterious ailments, and she would get hives, these debilitating full body hives, which would just knock her out of commission for months and months on end. And finally, I just had to try and pull it all together without, you know, at that time, you know, understanding of psychological illnesses was pretty rudimentary. Mm-hmm. And so they might not have even had a diagnosis of bipolar, which is manic depression. So I theorize in the epilogue that she might have had some sort of bipolar tendencies.
Perhaps it was because of the internal conflict of trying to be one thing in public and another thing, you know, in private.
Right, that could have been part of it. And as we you mentioned, these tendencies first seemed to start happening at Wellesley when she was in college.
She said, though, that she was at some point there very, very bored and even thought about getting married just to escape boredom. But she did, in fact, get married. And who did she marry? None other than
Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek. Well, in the 20s, after she went back to China, after in 1917, after graduating from Wellesley, she was courted by a great many men, including some Western American and European men that she dated, which was very scandalous at the time. And her family, of course, you know, they had many, many Western friends and belonged to the Methodist Church and sent their kids to school in the States, but getting married to a Westerner was quite another story, let me tell you. And so they were not thrilled that she was, you know, had some Western dates. But eventually she, you know, towed the family line, I guess you could say, and she married this young rising general named Chiang Kai-shek.
But he wasn't what one would have, or whom one would have expected the family to approve. I mean, he was a low rank. He was a soldier, which is a low rank in the society. He had three wives. He had some outstanding arrest warrants. He wasn't financially secure. And then worst of all, God forbid, he was Buddhist.
He was Buddhist, yeah. I don't think he was an actively practicing Buddhist, mind you. And he did have a, you know, a pretty lurid sort of past. He was educated as a military man. He wasn't an intellectual per se, although he had studied some of the Chinese classics and the Chinese scholars like Confucius and so on. So he wasn't an intellect like she was. She was a very, very bright, intelligent, fiercely intelligent and outspoken, articulate woman. And so it was a little surprising that she should marry someone like Chiang Kai-shek. And I think, you know, a lot of people ask that question even today. Why did she marry him? But I think it was because she was very, very ambitious. But in those days, especially in the, you know, the very sort of rigid socioeconomic class that she was in, which was a very wealthy, well-to-do kind of family and class, there were very limited opportunities for women. So she wanted, I think she married him to help fulfill her ambition, because obviously she couldn't be a political leader in her own right, she could marry someone who was.
So how did she see her role then as the Generalissimo's wife? How did she manifest
that?
Well,
she grew into the role. They married in 1927. And then she maintained a low profile for the first couple years. And then she started taking on a much more public role. She became a legislator in China.
She pushed Parliament to enact codes to protect married women. You know,
she did. She was involved in that, and you know, it didn't have a lot of impact in practice. There was still, you know, polygamy was accepted, and foot binding was widely prevalent, and
still,
so on. Not at that time, yeah, even well into the 30s.
Wow.
She, of course, did not have bound feet, her family, because they were Christian. So they didn't participate. They thought it was barbaric. But so she grew into the role. She started leading various movements and women's groups within her husband's nationalist party and in the government. And then she went on from there. She started writing lots of articles for magazines and newspapers in the United States. She started protesting the Japanese invasion of China in the 1930s. So through the 30s, she was developing this profile in the United States, and she was getting a lot of press coverage in American newspapers.
Christianity did play a big role in her life, and as a matter of fact, she claimed to have had a few spiritual experiences, but more so, though, I think it impacted. You mentioned that she was leading some movements, the New Life Movement.
Yes.
Talk about that a moment.
The New Life Movement was, you don't hear about it too much today, but it was a major movement that she and her husband's government launched in the 1930s, and she was really the guiding spirit behind the movement, and it was a slightly modeled after movements that were going on, similar sorts of movements that were going on in other countries at the time. For instance, in Italy, in fascist Italy, in Germany, there was a Vita Nuova movement going on in Italy. Of course, these were fascist movements, but they were intended to build up the country.
Morally.
There was the New Deal in the States, the New Deal, which was a little bit different, but, you know, so the New Life Movement was meant to not only build up the country in terms of, in practical ways, but also to bring a new spirit to the Chinese people, to renew the spirit of the people, to help build up the country, to fight off the Japanese invasion.
Actually, in many ways, the new movement sound very similar to the very Christian movement that in the South that we're known for, the blue laws, no gambling, no smoking, no spitting, no drinking, no dancing.
Right. And this,
no cosmetics.
Yeah, exactly. And this New Life Movement had a lot of elements of Christianity, thinly veiled. It wasn't said in so many words, but certainly a lot of aspects of that.
But I think it probably gave Mei Ling her own power base and a platform.
Absolutely.
Kind of for her to kind
of go. Yeah, so that's when she really took on a national role.
I was just getting ready to ask you, at what point did Mei Ling really begin to impact the policies and actions of her husband?
Well, I would say probably from very early on. I mean, the interesting thing about their relationship, even though her husband was a very traditional, conservative Chinese man. He'd never been in the West. I think he'd been to Moscow for a few months and Japan in military school. He didn't have a quote-unquote Western upbringing at all. Very traditional. But in traditional Chinese society at that time, the woman stood very much out of sight and behind the man and wasn't supposed to speak out and so on. But theirs was really a political partnership. And they, on many, many occasions, I know they argued loudly and long over issues of policy and so on. And so she had a lot of input into
She's often been compared to Eleanor Roosevelt and perhaps, you know, Eva Perón or maybe even Hillary Clinton. But she was actually at one point literally the commander of the Air Force in China.
She was. She actually took on an official role as the head of the Chinese Air Force in the late 30s, 36 to 38, I believe, for 2 years. And there was certainly a lot of resentment and jealousy among Air Force generals
I would
in China.
Think so.
Yes.
Oh.
Yes. And but you know, she was very loyal to her husband, and her husband needed someone he could trust to to do that. Plus, she at that time the Chinese Air Force was struggling, and they needed a lot of planes and equipment and technical expertise from foreign governments. And she could speak, of course, beautiful English, so she was the perfect.
So she was the one out there campaigning to generate funds and support.
Oh,
from,
yes, yeah,
from
very
the US
much so, and liaising
the
with
propaganda.
All the, all the foreign sources of funding, and she was right in the middle, the thick of things.
Well, if you've just tuned in, I'm Valerie Jackson, and I'm going between the lines with Laura Tyson Lee, who has written an intriguing biography of Madam Chiang Kai-shek, a serious force to be reckoned with and one of the most fascinating women of the 20th century, as she just said. The comments frequently made about her speaking abilities were usually that she was an excellent speaker. However, frequently people commented about the use of such unfamiliar or obscure words that sometimes people couldn't understand what she was saying, even though she...
Yes, it was very interesting. Whenever she made speeches in the United States, she labored over her speeches for weeks and months. And she must have, I don't know which dictionary she consulted, but her speeches were full of literary allusions and allusions to philosophers like Kant and Hegel and so on. She did major in philosophy at Wellesley. And she was very well read. In fact, she used words that a lot of Americans.
Well, I know I had to take the dictionary out. I'll confess, I pulled out the dictionary.
I did too. I didn't know those words.
As a matter of fact, there's an excellent part in the book, a couple of paragraphs that speaks to that. Would you read it for me, please?
Sure, I
pulled it
up
earlier.
This is in 1966 when she visited the United States on one of her speaking tours. And she addressed the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. The speech was largely ignored by newspapers, but the New Yorker magazine poked fun at her incomprehensible language. A grand ballroom full of dropped jaws and popped eyes greeted her talk as listeners struggled to decipher what she meant by such sentences as, "Das Kapital, by appropriating only the Hegelian triad, thesis, antithesis, and synthesis, which is part and parcel of the necessary progression of Hegelian schematic thought and applying it to the theme of social evils and injustices while discarding the Hegelian schema of harmonizing Greek ontology with Kantian psychology and the concept of the true being has built within Marxism the endemic limitations which cannot permit its synthesis to continue sound and healthy ad infinitum. Stooping to conquer had never been her métier, and she was not about to start now."
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh.
She went a little overboard in some of her writings, but, you know, she was just such an influential. She was one of the most powerful, controversial, and colorful figures of women figures of the 20th century.
So what was it then that kind of led to Madam's downfall? I mean, was she the manipulating, you know, extravagant diva that some say, or just what happened in the end?
Well, she, as I say, during the 30s, she was building up her profile in the United States, and all the reports were very, very positive. She was, you know, she was lauded as the power behind the throne in China and the face of modernizing Chinese womanhood and even as a woman of the world, you know,
right.
A woman on the world stage.
And American women were impressed
admired
and awed
her.
By
oh, yes. Mm-hmm. She was very much admired during the World War II. And she came to the States in 1943 and she addressed the U.S. Congress. She was the first woman of color to address the...
And only the second at the time, the second woman ever
yes,
to address the
U.S. Congress.
Mm-hmm.
She received tremendous adulation, and the press coverage was just blanket press coverage. She made many speeches across the country trying to get aid for China, aid and airplanes and munitions and so on and so forth, and... spoke to enormous crowds and she was very, very attractive, and she wore these slim-fitting dresses, Chinese dresses that were with a high collar and slit up the thigh and all the press reports. Of course, this is pre-television. So so you'd only hear it on the radio or read it in newspapers. So all the press reports have these very detailed descriptions of everything she was wearing, literally head to toe. And the sort of exoticism of her was played up. And I think a lot of Americans were just dumbfounded by how articulate she was and, you know, how intelligent she was. And, of course, the prevailing stereotype of Chinese in the United States at that time was coolies and laborers, laundrymen and so forth. And she just threw those stereotypes on their head. And so, as I say, during the war, she received tremendous adulation from Americans. And then after the war, things started to change, and there were a lot of rumors of corruption in her husband's government and a lot of criticism of her husband and his government and of her. And she was quite a diva. She really was a prima donna, and she always traveled with a huge entourage in the United States, secretaries and cooks and maids and nurses and doctors. And I think once this got out, a lot of people weren't too impressed with that.
It was a little bit of a backlash.
Yes, yeah. There was a backlash effect. Mm-hmm. And by the time, by the late 40s, I think there was a lot of negative coverage. Well, and then, of course, when the communists took over China and kicked out Chiang Kai-shek and his armies in 1949, and they went to Taiwan. By that time, there was a huge outcry.
Well, she was extremely anti-communist and never failed to really knock them whenever she could, if you might say so. But you also imply that she might have been what spurred that great McCarthy era of the communist witch hunt.
Yes, I think she was, I wouldn't say 100% behind that by any means. I mean, there were a lot of factors going, you know, contributing to that very dark era in American history. But she was, I did find files and documents and telegrams between her and her husband during the year of 1949, which she spent in the United States rallying the troops to lobby. It was called the China Lobby.
Yes.
And the China Lobby was basically to rally the troops and try to get American support for her husband's government. Well, that wasn't going to happen. But at the same time, behind the scenes, she worked to get certain people who had been opposed to her husband's government, in other words, those who were supporting the communists, denounced. And I think that she and some of her cohorts fed into the early days of the McCarthy campaign, because if you look at the early targets of McCarthy starting in February of 1950, right after the fall of Chiang Kai-shek, the very early targets, all of them were China experts in the State Department.
Mm.
Yes. China experts who had been in China, and all people she knew personally, diplomats who'd worked in China. And then only later did McCarthy expand his reach to the entertainment industry,
right,
and so on and so forth. But the early targets of McCarthy were the China experts.
Well, then came the reign of Nixon, and that's when things start to go from bad to worse for Madam and her husband, and the whole hope that that Taiwan would, you know, be recognized as the real China.
Right. Well, yes, exactly. And Nixon was an old friend of Madam Chiang Kai-shek and her husband, and he visited Taiwan starting in 1953 on many occasions, both when he was vice president and then later when he was out of government in the 50s and 60s. He visited, in his personal capacity as a lawyer. And so they became very good friends. And so when Nixon went to Beijing of course, Nixon was a very staunch anti-communist. And when Nixon went to Beijing in 1972, I guess it was, that just blew them away. They felt so horribly and bitterly betrayed by the recognition of Beijing by the United Nations and the trip to Nixon's trip to China. It was devastating for them. And shortly after, Chiang Kai-shek fell very, very ill. You know, within a few months after that, I think it was a blow that he just didn't recover from. Throughout the 50s and 60s, Chiang Kai-shek and Madam Chiang Kai-shek were calling on the U.S. to start a war help them invade China. So they could basically, it would have been starting World War III, which is what they wanted, because that was the only hope they would have to win back the mainland, reconquer the reconquest.
What would you conclude personally as the final legacy of Madam Chiang Kai-shek?
Well, you know, she was such an iconic figure. She was sort of the symbol for 30, 40 years. She was a household name in the States. She was sort of, her life closely paralleled the 20th century history of U.S.-China relations, because she had this incredible appeal in the United States. She was just such a, she was the public face of China in the West, and in particular the United States. There was this deep sort of emotional connection that Americans had with China. And, you know, that's why I like to say this book is as much, if not more so, American history as it is Chinese history, because it's the story of America's relationship with China over the 20th century. And she embodied that relationship. And I should mention, by the way, that she lived to be about 106. She was born in 1897, 1898, and died in October 2003. So her life spanned.
And she was living here in New York at the time, right?
Three centuries. Yes, she was living in New York.
Well, she was absolutely a fascinating woman. I thought, as the personally as the wife of a major of the excuse me. Personally, as the wife of the mayor of a major American city, I could relate to many of the issues that she had to deal with. However, my experiences only pale in comparison to what she had to deal with. I can. No wonder she had hives.
Yes, yeah. Well, it's not easy to be a political wife.
It
that's
really
for sure.
Isn't. And there was a problem. She even had some problems with narcotics because of her illnesses. She had to take so many
medications
and so forth. So it was not an easy life. But thank you so much, Laura, for bringing the real picture to us. I have a biography of Chiang Kai-shek at home, and it's 900 pages. And they only mention Madam maybe 10 or 12 times in a very obscure way. They don't give her any or very little of the credit that she probably does deserve. Thank you so much, Laura Tyson Lee, for allowing us to go between the lines with you today.
Thank you for having me.
Laura Lee's book is Madam Chiang Kai-shek, China's Eternal First Lady. To learn more about the books and authors featured on Between the Lines, listen to an archived program, or participate in the online book club. Visit our website at wabe.org/BTL. To subscribe to a podcast of the program, go to npr.org. Join us next week for another engaging program, because there's always more to learn when you go between the lines. The executive producer of this program is Lois Reitzes. Producer, Marjorie Lancer. Editor, Dave Barraswain. Technical producer, Ken Murray. Production assistant, Chichi Morka. Opening and closing music by Afro Blue. And I'm your host, Valerie Jackson. Funding for this program is provided in part by the UPS Foundation and the Fulton County Board of Commissioners under the guidance of the Fulton County Arts Council and the Georgia Council for the Arts. Between the Lines is a production of WABE.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available real-time traffic alerts. More at acura.com/RDX.